Brown, and we are here today again with another Lenses on Information Architecture Conversations about IA. And today I get to talk to my old friend, Uday Gajendhar. Uday, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Dan. It's a real pleasure to be here with you.
And it's always nice to see you. It's been a while since we've gotten to see each other in person, so it's great to actually see you. So I like starting these off just talking, especially with someone like you. You've been doing this a while. It doesn't look like it, but you know, I know that you've been doing this a while. So tell me a little bit about the ways that you have found to encourage your team to balance discovery and delivery, right? If we're talking about UX as overall kind of a design process, part of that design process is, yes, churning out artifacts so that development teams can build the stuff, but there's also a crucial learning component to all of that. What are some of your favorite techniques or ways that you encourage your teams to do both of these crucial aspects of UX?
Yeah, it's a great question. And indeed, I've been doing this for a long time. It's literally over 20 years now in which I've been doing this. And whether I was part of a team, you know, in the early days and now, you know, just leading teams, I keep coming back to just a few basic kind of, I guess, tenets, if you will, when it comes to discovery and delivery and how do you balance those two. The first is, you know, really asking yourself how confident you are about your assumptions and dependencies and expectations. I learned that from a mentor of mine way back when I first started at Oracle. And he impressed that upon me because I was kind of, you know, flying in there with, you know, trying to come out with all, you know, all these artifacts and assets and so forth. But I wasn't really questioning what are our assumptions. And the technical dependencies, and then ultimately the expectations of the stakeholders and everyone involved. So that's one of the key things that I encourage my teams to kind of think about. Another one, somewhat related, is what is the level of confidence you have about the problem framing and what you're trying to solve for. You know, sometimes that confidence may be, in a sense, projected upon you by, you know, another member of the team, maybe a product manager or an engineer, based upon some, well, their own assumptions and their own interpretations, and potentially even time pressures, deadlines, you know, that kind of a thing. And so I question, you know, or encourage my teams to question, how confident are you really? What do you know? What do you don't know? What do you think you need to know? And those are the three questions. We applied that framework just a couple of weeks ago when we held an in-person workshop. Nice. That proved very useful. Yeah.
I love the emphasis on confidence. And I think part of what I like about that is I think it helps maybe designers newer to the field to understand that they don't have to be 100% confident all the time about everything, right? That gauge or that meter is a tool that they can use, right? To say that even when I'm not as confident, there's still some utility in knowing that I'm not as confident.
Exactly. And I think it's a wonderful teachable moment, to borrow, I think that's Obama's phrase. We are on the discovery journey together to learn and understand about our customers, their goals and attitudes, and what really works best for them. And I think when a designer admits, you know, with some humility that I don't know, we don't know, we need to know some certain things, and let's go on that journey together, that helps, I think, bring temperatures down a bit and hopefully opens up some vulnerabilities where we can have some candid conversations about admitting, we have some questions, we have some doubts, you know, some suspicions, whatever. Well, let's have that conversation so that we can together figure that out.
That's awesome. So let's turn our attention to information architecture. And I think this feels like a space, you and I have played in this space for a while, but I feel like I'm seeing a resurgence of interest in IA. We can talk about that all day long, but maybe you can talk a little bit about the teams that you've worked with. What is the role that IA has played in how you get your teams to do design work? How have you encouraged your teams to adopt IA practices, even if they themselves don't call themselves IA or information architects?
Yeah, great question. Because the way I think of it is, you know, there's the famous three-legged stool model, right? There's engineering, there's product or business, and then there's design. Within design, I think that breaks down into a little mini three-legged stool as well. The way I've been thinking about it for over 20 years now, I think this goes back to grad school where I really picked this up. The three legs are, there's, you know, there's information, there's interface, and there's interaction. The information is something that needs to be communicated within an interface that presents some kind of, you know, expression of that. And that should enable some kind of interaction to get something done. When you think of it that way, and this is how I kind of encourage my teams to do it, yes, they are being presented with some kind of, quote, interaction design problem within the framework of UX and agile and delivery and so forth. But I encourage my teams to take a step back, many steps back, and really think about, what is the information? What is the content? What is the data? Is there a mental model of that? Is there a data model? What are the relationships? And really start doing quite a bit of mapping and diagramming of those objects and the relationships, because more often than not, there are some embedded assumptions about how we think these objects should relate and maybe don't relate, and how do they connect back to what the person is trying to accomplish in terms of, you know, using this feature, this task, you know, whatever it is. So I always try to encourage, and I've been doing this in my, you know, current job. When I first started, in fact, I do this at every job, I just realized, certainly over the past, you know, probably recently over the past decade or so, when I start a new job, I like to create a model and just diagram out the relationships, the objects, the attributes, the parameter, all this kind of stuff, and start creating these diagrams and use that to drive a conversation, which helps me kind of ramp up and onboard, you know, okay, what's the product? What's the ecosystem? Who are the stakeholders, et cetera, et cetera. And it turns out, you know, yes, it's an IA practice and methodology and so forth, but I see it more as a method of enabling a conversation, which goes back to your previous question about, you know, the knowns and the unknowns, and how do we increase our confidence? Let's go on that journey together. But for me, yeah, it's always about, let's go back to those maps and diagrams. Let's just get to those fundamental pieces. And then we can work out what's the interface and the interaction to support that.
What a great thing. And I'm picturing you sort of creating these maps and then shopping them around.
Yeah.
And I think there's utility, obviously, with the stakeholders, right, and helping you learn about the new business or whatever that you're dealing with. But I'm also picturing younger designers sort of watching you go through this learning process and, in a sense, being a role model for them to help them understand how this process works. I wonder, do you have any good stories for us about when a map or a diagram that you created really triggered a good conversation or kind of an aha moment for you?
Yeah. So a few years ago, I can talk about it now, it should be fine. I was at PayPal and I was working on the mobile reader. A lot of folks don't know that, you know, PayPal had a mobile reader, still has, and they went through some acquisitions and so forth and kind of evolved the product line. But it was the competitor to Square with the mobile swiper and so forth, and the chip card reader and everything. So when I started, I did one of my famous diagrams and really tried to map out, in effect, it was kind of a product functionality map. I just wanted to understand all the functionality of this gadget, this device, and let's just do a map of it. Like the relation, like it's almost like a geography of the product. And then use that. And this is where kind of the aha moments that came about, because, you know, I created it. I think I used like Illustrator at the time, and then printed it out. So, you know, there's a giant plotter there. So I just printed it out really nice and large, put it up on the wall. So that members of the cross-functional team, right, product engineering, et cetera, we could all look at it together. And it's like, you know, it's like, you know, you're like looking at this map of you know, this territory kind of thing, and realizing, oh, why does this sit there? What's the relationship here and there? And certain questions, you start seeing eyes open up. The one in particular, it had to do with this piece of functionality. And it was like, what is the purpose of that? Like, how is this really helping people? Which led to the next thought, oh, this could become a really cool heat map of where and how people use certain features, the frequency of it, et cetera, which led to a conversation around, oh, how can we get, I think we were using Amplitude at the time. How do we get Amplitude, you know, data analytics, you know, kind of piped in here and so forth. So it proved very powerful. But I had to show it. And this is the thing I miss about being in person. I'm a big fan of taking over the walls, print stuff large, put it on a wall, and get conversations happening, because people will turn their heads and look and go, what's going on here? You know?
Have you, Uday, that was such a good story. And I get so excited when I hear people printing out big diagrams.
Yes.
H-Shape's first big purchase back in 2007 was a large format printer. And Nathan is my business partner, and I were like, well, this thing is huge. And I think I was the only one with any kind of substantive basement. So it ended up at my house.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And I had it over there for many, many, many years. And even if I only used it once or twice a year.
Yeah.
And yes, occasionally it was for a kid's project, not for work. It was still just nice to print things out big. It finally died last year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. More than, I think 15. 14 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
It wouldn't go anymore. So,
well, you put it to good use. That's great.
Do you feel like this is a lost art? I'm gonna take a detour because I'm genuinely. It's nice to find someone else who likes printing out big diagrams.
Sure.
Do you feel like that is a lost art? I mean, when was the last time you saw a designer who maybe came up through a boot camp or what have you say, "Let's just make a big chart and print it out and see what happens."
I agree, you know, and certainly being in a pandemic and forced to work from home and all this kind of stuff hasn't helped. There's so much more emphasis on the shiny portfolio and having that cool deck, and even the case studyification of it, which becomes a commodified artifact. And so the art of doing the large artifacts to force the conversations, it gets lost, you know, which is kind of a sad thing.
Have you found, like the online whiteboards to be a reasonable facsimile, like Miro and Mural and those kinds of products? Or are you just like, no, big paper,
well,
I'm out?
I'll put it this way. They are a different animal, just by the very nature of being, you know, cloud-based SaaS, digital apps with infinite scalability, right? And yet when you interact with them virtually, you can have 30, 40, even 100 people all at one time. Jim Kaulbach, who we both know, you know, actually did a demo of Mural showing like 100 people at one time, you know, going through, putting stickies. It was getting crazy. The result was pretty powerful. It is a different kind of impact than the physicality of paper on a wall. I will just never forget, if I can recount one quick short story.
Oh, yeah, of course.
My very first time actually doing the whole large printer plotter thing was back at Oracle, when I remember distinctly being assigned to this project as kind of a junior designer by the PM to really just kind of clean up the UI, just, you know, use the design system components and so forth, and just, you know, fit the standards and all that. But of course, you know, me, my curiosity, I'm like, yeah, but I really want to understand this product. And so I created this massive sitemap, basically this IA diagram, all the pages, all the links I could find, created it. At the day of the review, yes, I presented the cleaned up UI and so forth. But I also unfurled this 7-foot-long diagram and put it up on the wall. And people were like, what is this all about? And I just did a quick spiel to just kind of walk through it and explain, you know, I felt like it was my responsibility to identify, you know, dead ends and places that just didn't make sense and just weird organizational mapping and relationships kind of stuff. That was such an impactful moment. It caught the PM off guard, but I think in a good way. And the project became a restructuring, architecting kind of initiative, which I don't know if that would have happened if I didn't force the issue with the giant, you know, diagram on the wall.
That's amazing. What a great story.
So I think it's a valuable art. It's a necessary art. The question is now, how do we translate that impact and power to something like a mural or a Miro? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a different experience.
Yeah.
To see it digitally like that. Yes, you can zoom out, and yes, you can zoom in, but you're never going to get to the resolution that you've got when you've got it in real life, where you're sort of and you're physically interacting with it.
Exactly. So, yeah. I do wonder. Part of me would like to actually just print one of those out. You know, you can use FedEx or whatever. Right, just print it out. And then, just send them out and see what it's like. And then send that out.
Yeah.
Like literally just ship it to your friendly PM and engineering lead.
Look what I did.
Yeah, exactly. They can unfurl it in their house and kind of stick it up or whatever.
That's amazing. We've started doing this, but let's maybe ask more directly. I'm sort of at this stage in my career, and maybe you are too, where it's like, we've been doing this for a while. There is some conventional wisdom that I feel like is starting to crumble, right? There are some underlying assumptions we have about how UX works. And I wonder if, I feel like this idea of lenses has been really appealing to me because I'm now looking at the practice of user experience through some new lenses, right? Let's you and I take a new lens to UX or IA. Is there one aspect of user experience that you think needs to be examined more closely? Is there one piece of the pie piece of the puzzle that you feel like deserves greater attention to say, wait, we've done it this way for as long as I've been doing this. There's got to be a better way. There's got to be another way of looking at this.
Yeah. I mean, there are quite a few angles to that question. I keep coming back to education, really, UX education, which I think manifests itself in terms of how UX designers practice that work, right? I was about to say practice the craft, and maybe that's the issue. There's some bit of craft that's being lost. Connecting back to what we were just saying with, you know, printing out large diagrams and stuff, but also within user experience, has there become an over attachment to design systems and componentry, to very slick case studies? Even if you're not looking for a job and, you know, you just want to create a case study, right? That kind of shows off what you can do. And then the biggest one, perhaps the most nefarious of the three, agile delivery. And I should say agile delivery, right? Regardless of the methodology, Scrum, Common, you know, whatever it is. But the over-reliance on velocity and shipping features without questioning. And so maybe that's it, right? That maybe it's something about the craft of questioning. When I was in grad school, my thesis advisor, Dick Buchanan, gave me this book. It was called The Craft of Research. And I still have it. It's my bookshelf back there. It's actually a book about questioning and how do you ask those questions so as to formulate, well, a thesis and so forth. And so I wonder, is there something about the research aspect, the questioning aspect, that interrogative, inquisitive aspect that's being lost because of the over-reliance on the output, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that's really great. I've also recently become preoccupied, fascinated by questions, which I feel like is if you tear away everything else about UX at the heart of it, at its core, it's questions, right? It's sort of this drive to, as you put it, this kind of inquisitive aspect. And I you started out by saying that education is what needs re-examining, and I really appreciate that. And I also wonder if part of the problem of education is that they are teaching answers, not questions. That they are. And I've not been through a boot camp, so I don't know. But what I worry about is that folks come out of that thinking, well, I know how to do UX. I know how to make a wireframe. I know how to make a mock-up. I know how to run a research study. Even if they are asking questions or running usability tests, even though they're asking questions, there's still questions at the heart of what we do. And maybe that part has been lost too.
I too have not been through a boot camp. I've given guest talks and so forth, and I feel like there's something about that. It's about the yeah the solutions and the answers and the outputs and the toolkits and so forth. Just very quickly going back to grad school, Buchanan talked about grammar and rhetoric, methods and tools versus rhetoric, which is more about questions and philosophical framing. So in the graduate seminar, and I was actually just rediscovering some of my old notes the other day. I was cleaning some my closet out and stuff. The central point of it is about meaning and significance. Where does meaning come from? Does it come from you, the designer? Does it come from the product that you designed? Does it come from the user using the product? Does it come from the stakeholders? Or, there's this whole ecosystem, but it requires you to question and understand so that you can get to a better answer versus something that's kind of cranked out through a toolkit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm super interested to pick up the craft of research now.
All right.
At what point in your career did you feel like this was apparent to you? At what point in your career did you sense that there was a need to examine the practice more closely?
I think honestly, it came about. I want to say I would track it back to when I became kind of a senior design leader. And that is to say, I became a principal designer at Citrix, and we were undergoing the whole design thinking kind of, we were going through that wave. So cultural change, process change, et cetera, et cetera. And sure, we kind of went through, the steps and process of doing design thinking workshops and all that kind of stuff. But I remember also the questioning aspect of like, why are we doing this? And what's truly the benefit and the value? And that's when I recognized the this kind of I was just thinking about the Spider-Man quote, great power and great responsibility. So if we have the power to change an organization through design, there's a lot of responsibility that comes along with that, because now everyone's a little bit dangerous, with the design, thinking toolkits and methods and approaches and whatever, which, can be kind of a good thing, could be kind of a bad thing. I don't know. But I think that's when I started to realize we need to think deeply about the purposes and values, the intentions of whether you're designing an organization or designing a product. And then what are the frameworks that help drive effective questioning around that, which requires research and learning and understanding. and kind of connects back to the lenses as well. You got to figure out what those lenses are and apply those lenses and, you know, see what the right combination could elicit better questions and hopefully more fulfilling answers.
Right. Nice. So this has been great. And it's been so great to catch up and talk to you about this side of your, you know, life and your work. And I wonder if you might help me deconstruct a preconception that I have about information architecture. And I realize that this is me sort of putting a tremendous amount of labor on you that I should be doing myself. So I just
want to
tell you at the outset, I'm grateful for your time to do this. But one of the preconceptions that I think we have in the IA space is that we should very closely align our hierarchy or our navigation categories with user needs. And I mean, I say this out loud and it seems so self-evident to me because I was sort of forged, as I think you were, in kind of the user-centered design philosophy and methodology, right? So when we create navigation, they should align with user needs. Is it reasonable for us to call that into question? Do you think there's an opportunity for us to think about how we design navigation differently?
Oh, yes. I've been through a few navigation redesign efforts within over the past few years. And, you know, I think the approach I've been taking, I went through kind of the standard practice of like, yes, let's understand user mental models and user needs, and then let's figure out some structure that can align with that. And I remember this was, my previous company. We went through that approach, a very kind of textbook approach. Where we landed, actually, probably it didn't elicit the 100%, you know, thumbs up from users. Now, obviously, it depends on who you talk to and all, you know, the different kinds of users and so forth. And it's also the challenge of enterprise software because the different types of customers you engage with. But we realized that there was also the additional impacts or relationship with internal product organizational values, if you will, branding and identity. And yeah, there's a desire. No one wants to ship the org chart. At least we say that. But there is still the political dynamics of where and how certain words are surfaced, what that sequencing is, and how does that connect back to the broader message about the product and the platform. So it's not a cut and dry textbook kind of a thing. There are other factors at play, which connects me back to, we did ultimately finish that project and we landed at a place that felt sufficiently useful and functional for users while trying to address some of the internal desires around branding and culture and that kind of a thing. What I wanted to connect back to, I think you've seen the famous, Eames diagram, right? It's like it's a Venn diagram, right? So a bunch of squibbles of circles are all kind of interconnected. It's a mishmash, right? And the idea is that it's all very volatile and is changing. But that diagram in particular represents the heart of navigational design challenges. It's messy.
I mean, you've brought up this other piece of, or this corresponding piece of conventional wisdom, where you said don't ship the org chart, but I think there was also sort of this notion that navigation should be pure. Navigation should be kind of devoid of politics. Navigation should be kind of very perfectly represent what you can do with this product. Nothing more, nothing less. And I mean, yes, over the last, let's call it 5 to 10 years, I've been pushing this idea that the navigation plays a role in branding as well, right? It helps me communicate to the customer not just what can you do on the site or with this product, but what does this organization want to be? Like, what is the relationship that we are creating between you, the customer, and this organization as well? That the burden on navigation is much bigger than simply wayfinding. Do you feel like, I mean, that conversation can be dangerous, right? Because we want to serve the needs of the users, and now we're sort of teasing this idea that there's other things that you can and maybe should be doing in the navigation as well. Have you, in the sort of revelation that you've had, have you had developed any techniques, any approaches for walking that fine line? What's the right way someone, if you were giving advice to a younger designer, how would you suggest that they kind of go about asking the right questions for their navigation?
Yeah, I would still prioritize user needs and goals, number one. But doing so with eyes wide open, that there are other, I don't know, mitigating factors, extenuating factors, whatever, to be aware of, which goes back to, I mean, that piece of advice. It's like building allies and developing relationships with key people within the organization as much as possible. And you kind of have to feel that out. If a certain company is very engineering driven versus very brand driven versus whatever, you know, who are those drivers and how can you kind of find them and talk to them and really try to invite them to be part of that process, so that you're not just kind of saying, "Here, I did it the UCD way. Boom, I'm done." No, I'm glad you did that, but you want to make sure everyone else feels like they were included and part of that, and at least had their objections or points of view raised, and you're trying to address them. It's a political thing, but not in the nasty way. It's just trying to figure out what's the right balance of agendas.
And Uday, that was great. I think we will leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dan. This was great. Had a lot of fun.